Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We decided it's high time we do an episode about Mary Jane.
Marijuana, things are happening.
That's right. This episode is about pot. We're exploring the rhetoric surrounding legalization in New York's recent gubernatorial primaries. And a cheesemonger turned cannabis consultant shares the tricks of the trade.
Great. So do you want to conquer the world? Do you want to have hazy eyes? Do you want to, you know, just relax all day and be floaty?
And we find out how one exemplary South Carolina farmer is trying his hand at a new crop.
Every plant that comes up from seed is different. And so it's learning how the plant grows, how it responds, and then familiarizing myself and my senses with this plant.
Plus, Hannah Forden and I taste test the hottest new cocktail ingredient, CBD. So subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to know when the newest episode of Meat and Three drops.
Kane, welcome to In the Sauce, a new podcast about building consumer brands. When we launched a line of fresh sauces for grocery stores last year, I knew we were jumping into something crazy. So in my effort to get myself educated, I started meeting everyone I know and respect who could advise me, from production gurus to PR and social media mavens. Then I started having those conversations here as a podcast so that other entrepreneurs can learn as well. This is the story of Haven's Kitchen Sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand, because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Alex Ingles, founder of Pilot Kombucha, a 3.5-year-old company that is thriving in the competitive and rapidly growing world of functional beverages. I've been waiting to talk to Alex since the day I tasted Pilot because, honestly, it's the only kombucha I've ever liked. And also because I think it's branded really perfectly and I think it's poised for great things. So welcome, Alex.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Usually we're going to spend some time talking about sort of how you got into what you got into and hear a little bit about your life story, et cetera. But before any of that happens, can you just please tell me what a SCOBY is?
SCOBY is the symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. So that's the, this is going to sound really gross, but the bacterial mat that you put into kombucha to kickstart the fermentation.
And is that like the mother when
yes.
you're making sourdough?
Exactly,
and does it get
yeah.
passed down from like
yep.
generation to generation?
Yep. And it grows and expands. So it's in sourdough, it's different because you're reusing it. And it doesn't propagate. You have to feed it. And that's
right.
what propagates it.
Yeah.
SCOBY will just sort of grow given the right conditions.
So is Pilot from some SCOBY that was given to you by some old man in a cave 3.5 years ago?
No, I actually grew my own because I have just always been extremely thrifty. I looked it up on the internet when I started to brew kombucha and,
awesome.
And decided to, you know, why would I buy something if I could make it myself?
Okay.
Customers don't listen to me. Buy Pilot kombucha.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, so back to the funny thing about I feel like this show is, I'm always like, so when you were 5, did you know you wanted to be a branding consultant? Like,
yes,
did
I
you know
knew that I was right. going to start a Pilot kombucha company when I was 5 years old.
Right.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So that's always been your life dream.
Yes.
Yeah. So what did you really like? What were you into?
You know, it's interesting. I'm part of this Vistage group that's like for small business owners. It teaches leadership skills. And we did an exercise that asked that question mm-hmm. and sort of has you look for ties to what you're doing now. So I always wanted to be a teacher.
Me too.
Really all the way through grad school. Well, so it makes sense for you because
yeah.
you started Haven's
yes.
Kitchen, which is a cooking school
yeah,
first. And so like
sense.
For me, I got to grad school and was like, oh my God, academia is just red tape
right.
and hurdles and public speaking and
all the things
people love
right.
and I you know I got my master's degree and was like, well, I guess I'm just gonna go work in food again because that's what I had done in undergrad. So
just to pay rent and help.
Yeah, just to pay rent. And I think after about 2 years of, you know, I was doing a baking blog because that's what everybody did in the early 2000s. And I knew that I wanted to do some sort of food company. So when I was like 22 or 23, but took, you know, yeah, 5 or 6 years to figure out what it would be.
So when you, so were you always a food lover? Like, were you one of those people that, you know, I feel like we can almost see each other across the room, like food people, you know, like there's some people that go to foreign cities and they're like, oh, I went to this museum and I saw that amazing building. And I'm like, I really
don't care.
Like, all I want to know is what'd you eat? You know, were you a food person? Do you come from a food family?
Basically, not from a food family, but basically until like right when I was a baby and up till now, I'll just like eat until I'm sick if I'm given the opportunity.
Great. So
yeah, it's really healthy. But when I got into cooking at a very young age, I basically told my parents that, you know, I don't want to do dishes anymore. And my dad was like, okay, well, if you don't want to do dishes, you can cook dinner because you still have to do chores.
Right.
And it was actually my dad and my grandfather that taught me how to cook. My grandfather was really the cook in the family. My mom's not a cook still.
Mine neither. That's cool. And then, so you, what was your first job in food?
I worked at Subway as a sandwich artist.
They call them sandwich artists?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Is that?
I'm not joking.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you feel, did you have any creative license at Subway or?
No.
It was like pretty by the book,
It was very by the book. It was a campus job. So I was at the Subway on campus.
But it must have not been that bad since you...
No, it wasn't that bad at all. And from Subway, I graduated to a local deli. Great. So yeah, I made great strides in that arena. And then
did you get to be like, I'm going to just put a little extra vinaigrette on this? Or it was...
No. I didn't really have any sort of creative food job until maybe I was 23 or 24. I was working at Saucy by Nature, which was doing falafels at Smorgasburg.
Oh, cool.
And they had a variety of sauces and things, and they did specials every month, so three different kinds of falafels. And they were like, hey, come up with a falafel menu. It was really just creative at home more than professionally.
Okay. And then how did you end up getting into kombucha?
I was working at Whole Foods and drinking heavily, as you do in your 20s after a rough breakup. And somebody recommended kombucha as a hangover cure.
Interesting.
And it worked so well. Yeah, it's really high in B vitamins. Mm-hmm. It worked so well. I bought another one the next day and another one the next day. And, you know, by the end of the week, I was like, okay, like I can make this better.
Yeah.
So, like, let's Google search and started brewing it myself. And as I got into the brewing and drinking it more daily, I also found that there are some really great benefits to my digestive system. I've always struggled with issues because I had my gallbladder taken out at, I think I was 19.
Wow.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty young for that surgery. And the doctors had at the time basically said, like, well, you're always going to have this issue unless you
change your diet completely.
Really watch your diet, or we can put you on medication. You'll be on the medication for the rest of your life. And I was really like, neither of those are great options.
Right. And yeah, I'll just drink kombucha.
I'll just deal with these issues.
Right.
And then, yeah, and then kombucha basically fixed the issue completely for me.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I tried making jam once. So I'm very comfortable with like cooking. What I'm really uncomfortable with is anything that seems scientific in any way. So if anything can like explode or cause death, I'm nervous about it. So not to say that, you know, you could cause death, but
oh my God, but the bottles can explode. I've had a homebrew bottle explode once, and it was at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And yeah, it sounds
How did you
terrifying.
Figure out how, like, okay, Googling, you just Googled and it was just trial and effort? Were you ever nervous?
Yes, I tell everybody that if you want to start a business, just start Googling.
It's
better than an MBA, honestly.
It's true. I mean, it's interesting that you say that because it actually leads into some of my questions about the category, right? Because now that everyone can pretty much make a pretty label and Google how to make anything.
Yes.
They're very low barriers to entry in a lot of these different, especially food. And I mean, I I won't mention her name, but I know a young woman who's basically taking essential oils from like random places on the internet. She's young. She's not like our age or my age or your age. She's young, but she's like bottling them in these little things and putting on a cute label and selling them to her friends on Instagram for like money. I mean, she's making money. So my point is that it's not that hard to start anything. I think what's hard is to scale it.
Build it.
And like have it be like, have it continue to function in the world.
Yes.
And I think what people starting businesses don't always think about is like, which I certainly didn't, because I just wanted to like make Haven's Kitchen. And then about a year or two in, when I realized, okay, I had made it, like it was functioning, it was sustainable. Now what? I was sort of freaked out. Like now I have to run this business for like how long?
I don't know.
Like how long do I do this for? And how are people going to keep staying here? And all those questions. Okay. So you were working at Whole Foods. You started making this at your home. You had one flavor. You had a few flavors. You were playing around.
Oh, I was playing around like crazy when I started brewing kombucha, because the whole reason I stopped buying it at the store was because they didn't have like the flavor combinations that I really wanted to try. You know, with tea, there's, a world of variety, even if you're just looking at black tea, let alone green tea, white tea, matcha, teas that are native to the Americas. It's really just insane. And then you add, you know, botanicals, seeds, herbs, all these other things that at the time kombucha breweries, the bigger companies, weren't really using, which is, you know, at the time was GT's was the only company out there. I was using teas that I liked to drink, herbs that I liked to cook with, and supplement my healthcare regimen with. That was just all, it was all over the place.
And then did you start putting it in a bottle and giving it to people? Like how did you go from like what?
Not really. No. I mean, I was brewing really small batches, so a gallon at a time. And if I got a little bit backed up, then I would like bless my coworkers with a bottle of homemade kombucha for them to share. And yeah, eventually it was a chef that I was working under that grew up hating kombucha. Her mom lived on a commune.
It like represented everything.
Everything she hated. It was a continuous brew, so like very acidic, and her mom made her drink a half a cup a day for her immune system. Yeah. So she, you know, always made fun of me for making my own kombucha, and eventually I was like, just try it. Like, it's not going to kill you.
Right.
And she tried it, and
I mean, I don't know how much it's evolved, but like,
it's
really not that vinegary.
Yeah.
I don't know, you know.
Yeah, it's gentle. I like to use beer terminology, so I call it like crushable, and it's got a really great hydrating mouthfeel, which a lot of kombucha companies can end up coming out a little bit dry.
Right.
Which to me defeats the, unless it's wine, like I don't want to drink a dry beverage because I'm thirsty.
Right. Yes, that seems to defeat the purpose. Okay, so now I want to get to when you made your first sale of it. Like, you remember it?
I do. It was actually here at Roberta's.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do they know that?
I'm sure somebody somewhere knows. Yeah. So my brother was working don't remember the department at the time. He was making pizza here.
Right.
And they had just opened the takeout.
Right.
And they were looking for a kombucha company. And he said, oh, my sister makes great kombucha. You should talk to her. So the company did not even exist yet time.
That's amazing.
He was just like, yeah, my sister's going to do this thing. So I brought them a couple of bottles of homebrew, just the flavors that I had on hand, which happened to be blueberry, lemongrass, and grapefruit mint.
Yum.
And they were like, oh, yeah, this is great. We can we'll take 4 cases. When can we get it? And I was like,
cases of what?
Right. A month.
Yeah.
A month, maybe. And yeah, so I like called my friend who did all the branding for me very quickly. And I had another friend who was running a commercial kitchen who let me rent shelf space basically and booked time and brewed my first 10 gallons of kombucha and literally walked it over here from my apartment because I didn't have a walk-in refrigerator.
And that, so It has to be refrigerated.
It has to be refrigerated.
And that's because it will continue to ferment and get more alcoholic?
Correct, yeah.
And then it turns into like an alcoholic beverage.
It'll turn into an alcoholic beverage. The biggest issue really is safety. So the pressure can build up in the bottles.
Right.
And they can
become
little
bombs. So it's not so much like
bombs.
What you can... Yeah, that would be bad.
Yes.
On that note, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk category and building the brand and growth since day one here at Roberta's.
Great. Sounds good.
Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie? Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie? Oh, won't you save all your pumpkin pie just for me, girl? Please don't give none away. Let it get sweeter by the day. Oh, won't you save it, baby? Won't you save it? Oh, won't you save it all for me?
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
I want you to save it, baby.
Hi there, I'm Allie Kane. I'm back with my guest Alex Ingalls, founder of Pilot Kombucha. And we left when you were selling your first couple of cases. You had a friend design a label. I know it couldn't have been that easy. but then what happened? I mean, because I feel like you're everywhere. And yeah. I feel like the last thing I read was an interview where you were having a problem keeping up with demand, which I do want to talk about a little bit because, sure. And I'll just give my experience, which I tend to do, but, we had our first PO and it was kind of perfect because like we produced exactly the same amount as the purchase order came in for. And it was like, lovely, lovely, lovely. And then a day and a half later, we got another PO. And we thought it was coming in like at least 2 weeks. Like we had no idea that that was going to happen. And I remember speaking to one of my advisors and just sort of like being freaked out. And it was a good thing. And I knew it was like a good problem to have, but people say it's a great problem to have. And yet it feels really terrifying.
Least favorite phrase.
Yeah. and he said, you know, every growing company has the day where those two things are not aligned. What you can make and what you need to make aren't aligned. And what you need to do is you need to have a plan to mitigate for when you make too much. And then you need to have a separate plan for what happens when you can't make enough. And every founder makes the decision, do I want to make too much and never be out of stock? Or is it more expensive, you know, and harder? And should I just try to like stick to my plan a little bit and not make enough and face some out of stocks, but sort of try to fix those relationships? Consumers are okay when they feel a little bit like they can't get something that they want. The problem for us has been the buyers at the stores.
Empty shelf space, yeah.
Empty shelves. Just keeping them from being mean to you. B, making sure no one moves into your space. But where are you now with your supply and your demand?
So we actually just doubled production. So we're at a really happy space. Yeah.
Awesome.
And we're already planning on when we can double again. So right now we actually do have some inventory before our next fill date, which
that's
is
great.
Actually today is packing day.
Right. And how did you get from, you know, like, because people who are listening, like, this is what they want to know. Like, what happened when, I mean, when did you realize you needed to increase your production and how did you go about doing it?
Yeah. Well, so the first order that we brewed, the Roberta's order, you know, I made 5 gallons of each flavor. And so I had 2 cases of each flavor left over. And it was like, okay, well, I guess I have to find 2 more customers to take these cases.
Right. And I'm really getting nitty gritty. You bought the bottles.
Yeah. Right. I think the first time I bought them, I got them somewhere bad, like Uline or something. Right. I just didn't know any better.
How would we know?
Yeah. And I went out and got 2 more customers and then I was out for 2 weeks.
Right.
So I booked more shelf space. I grew out of that space.
And
do you
have a distributor? Yes.
I have 3 distributors right now. Yeah. Okay. So that didn't come until very recently though.
You were like,
we were doing self-distribution. Yeah. Right. So the first year of business, I was doing everything myself. I was brewing, labeling bottles, sealing the bottles, doing all the deliveries, all the sales calls, the invoicing, the social media, whatever it was when I first started,
around social media.
Yeah. Right. We didn't even have a website until like 3 to 6 months into the business.
Right. Well, cause you had a product. I mean, I had a product
and I was making sales and I was like, who needs a website?
Right. No, I mean, it's interesting. There's so many people out there with just like bullshit on a stick and really beautiful. Do you want to quote that? Really beautiful, like colors and branding and like very cool sort of like Instagram. That's like very evocative. And yet you're sort of like, but your product isn't great. Like what's your you know?
And I think from the get go, we had great design, great product, and it almost the bottle sitting on the shelf gave this appearance of we were much, much bigger than we actually were. Yes. People would then go to the Instagram and be like, oh.
Right. No, but that's, I mean, it's great. So the friend that designed the label, did she do the website and everything too?
It's a he. And no, he did not do the website, which actually needs quite a bit of work. We're working on that right now. No, he just did the bottles. He did the stickers.
Right. How'd you come up with the name Pilot?
We have a strong history of aviation in my family. So my dad, my granddad, my great uncle, and I think their father. Wow. Basically, since there was a flying part of the military, someone on my dad's side of the family has been a pilot.
That's very cool.
Until my generation. Right. So me and my brothers were the first to not go into that.
Okay. And the flags on the...
The flags like, based on, Navy flag. I don't remember. Semaphore coding. Yeah.
Like so Alpha Romeo.
My dad was in the Navy. So, it comes back down to that. And then our little stickers that I think I've given you a couple of, those are based on squadron patch designs.
Very cool.
Yeah. So it all ties back into the military history. We're pro-vet, but anti-war.
Right. Love it. Yeah. So I jumped and got into... supply. So you started off and you were gathering your customers, and did you have a hard time selling into stores at all? Were they?
No.
Right.
I mean, it's
and stores
it's the
more
craziest
than cafes
thing.
Or?
A little bit of both. Yeah. We did a lot of cafes, a lot of specialty grocery stores. So like I really started off with like the places that I really liked to shop, like Campbell's Cheese, Bedford Cheese. Mm-hmm. Foster Sundry is one of my best customers, Fleischer's Butcher Shop. Right. So like places that I really liked to shop that I thought that, you know, my fellow customers at those places would probably enjoy what I was making.
Right.
But when I started Kombucha Brooklyn, which was the big company, when I started drinking kombucha, they had just won the like rebranding contest and they were really big, but then kombucha had that big alcohol scare. So they got out of production.
Right.
And really just left this gaping hole in
Brooklyn.
The market. Yeah. For a bottled kombucha product, that was made locally. So they were still doing kegs, but they didn't have any bottles on the shelves, and that made it extremely easy for us to step in.
So let's talk a little bit about alcohol and sugar. because from what I understand, and I've done like a little bit of research, from what I understand, the big issue is that when you stick your nutritional label on it, the alcohol content and the sugar content are one thing.
Yeah.
But Or they vary?
They vary, yeah. I mean, it's a living product, so you can test it at every stage of its life, of its shelf life, which we do. Mm-hmm. We send out to Cornell Wine Lab to do all our testing, and we test at fresh, we test at 3 months, and then we test again at 6 months, which is 1 month past our actual approved shelf life.
To measure for microbes, but also for alcohol.
No, we don't actually have to do microbe testing. So kombucha has no known pathogens. So it's really just alcohol and residual sugar. That's and because it's living, I mean, it can change from batch to batch, it can change, you know, from one day to the next, let alone.
And I mean,
if someone doesn't
necessarily, like, if it's out for a few hours and it's not constantly in the fridge, it can grow a little more, maybe. Or is that?
Yeah, I mean, a couple hours. It depends on how hot it is.
Right.
Yeah. If it's like 90 degrees and you're sitting out in the sun, then yes, absolutely. Right. It might grow.
So what's the scare? Like, the scare is that it gets too alcoholic?
The scare is that it becomes too alcoholic, yeah. So if it gets past 0.5%, and I really think this is more safety-driven than anything else. So, like, mm-hmm. you have, you know, people in certain religions who don't drink alcohol. You have people who are in recovery who maybe drink kombucha but aren't aware of the alcohol content.
Right. Kids.
Kids, yeah, kids, pregnant women. So if the alcohol content goes above 0.5 for the consumer, it can be scary. But as a business owner, we're worried about that, plus the taxing, the regulations.
Right.
You can get slapped with a really big fine if you're selling an alcoholic product as a non-alcoholic product.
And does the sugar content also go up over time?
No, if anything, it would go down.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's being converted into alcohol as it ages.
Like, there's no... It's like there's not much sugar, and it's really low calorie, and it tastes delicious.
Yeah, low glycemic index beverage.
Right. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so you figured out that you need to produce more. You were brewing. You first were in your own kitchen, then you went to someone's production kitchen, and then where'd you go from there?
From there, we moved in with She-Wolf Bakery.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So the first year we were in, it's like semi-private space. So we had our own little room, but we used their sinks.
Was it
their
still just you?
Loading dock, their walk-in. It was still just me.
The royal we.
Yeah. Yeah. The royal we. I hired a delivery driver on my 29th birthday.
Amazing. Made
a joke that it was like my birthday gift to myself, and that I was at that point a little bit under a year in business.
Right.
And I totally poached him from a former employer.
And he
just bad form, but
a refrigerated
I think it
van,
worked out.
Presumably.
Well, we were renting.
Right.
Yeah. But actually for the first year and a half, I think we were delivering out of my Honda Element.
Got it. Okay, cool.
We actually didn't do refrigerated delivery until about a year ago.
Right.
And then, I mean, the renting logistics are just a nightmare here
in
New York.
No, I mean, keeping it cold is...
It's critical. I mean, it's critical.
It's
we have
also
some
just
safety
the biggest
issues.
Big pain in the neck. I mean, it's the number one thing people said, don't do fresh refrigerated sauces because... cold chain, you know, distribution is a pain. And then you get into, you know, who can distribute it for you, and they need to be refrigerated. Right. And then, how do you,
and
know?
New York, you know, refrigerated space is at a very high premium. Yeah.
So, let's talk about the segments a little bit. I want to talk about the category because I don't think that I certainly, when I started a sauce company, did not, I mean, I eventually did, but I didn't look at like the categories of supermarket buying and decide there's a white space in the, you know, in the sauce market. But now that I know that there is, and now I can speak to it, you know, and I will say, like, when I'm talking to sort of future entrepreneurs or, you know, students at ICE or whatever it is, you know, try not to go into a really crowded category. But you didn't go into a crowded category. You just
got into a category that started
growing really fast.
Yeah.
And that's kind of my question. So presumably ours is going to be the same thing. right? I mean, fresh sauce is not my own idea. People are figuring out how to do it and how to build it. I guess the question for you is, are you thinking, you know, what are the goals a little bit? Is the goal eventually to sell to one of the big sort of strategic, you know, companies? Do you want to be a national brand? Are you, you know, are you kind of hoping that you own New York and then that's the goal? Or, you know, like, because I feel like there are two that are sort of the big mamas.
Yeah.
There's Health Aid and GT.
You know, it's funny. Health Aid actually isn't even the number two
selling.
It
just feels like it.
Yeah, they're just here in New York. They came out here before the other big dogs. So it's actually Kavita. GT's, not even Kavita. No. Well, GT's Kavita. I don't count Kavita because it's not real kombucha.
Okay.
GT's Hum Kombucha, mm-hmm. Brew Doctor, and then Health Aid is number four.
Got it. And those are all nationally distributed.
Those are all nationally distributed, yeah. And Hum even has some international distribution.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So is that the goal?
No, I actually think you really have to alter the product to a level that I think loses some of the health benefits, some of the like homebrew feel that I feel like our kombucha has. So no, I would be totally happy with staying a regional independent owned kombucha company and really cornering the Northeast market and having a home base here in Brooklyn.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. There are all these different founders with all these different plans. And the truth is you can have you don't have to go all the way, you know, big
you
and sell
especially
to
especially here
Pepsi,
in New York,
you know?
The market's so big that you could really, I mean, run thrive a good and grow and make see millions in net sales and not even leave New York.
And doing it that way also maybe means that you don't have to take in a lot of money, right?
Sure.
I mean, because if you're growing organically and you're growing in your home base, I think the reason why a lot of brands feel that they need a lot of outside money is to build awareness in areas that aren't their home base, you know? But if you're kind of growing it from like Brooklyn out. Then you don't necessarily need to bring in all of this money. Do you want to talk about money?
Sure. There's not much to talk about really for us. We haven't taken outside funding. It's been all friends and family, and all women friends and family, except for my younger brother who gave us $1,000 the first year we started.
Just because he's a good guy.
Yep.
Yeah. And is it going to start paying for itself or does it pay for itself?
Yeah, it pays for itself. Yeah, actually. So
that's
basically from the first year it started paying for itself.
Right.
We've been very bootstrapped. We started with $8,000.
Wow.
And then the first loan we took out was when I realized I was getting kicked out of my She-Wolf shared space.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to buy a walk-in. I needed a warehouse space.
Right.
We needed to rent U-Hauls to move everything.
The lab testing, too, is expensive. I mean,
actually,
for us it is. No? Maybe because we have more pathogens.
I mean, you add into more SKUs, I mean, it depends on how many tests you do. We're really only testing for ABV and residual sugars.
Right.
So that's, you know, I don't know, $120 per bottle.
Oh, my gosh. Mine's like, I guess because it's HPP, mine's like $7,000 per SKU.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Through Cornell?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
But, I mean, they need to do, like, a whole validation.
All the plate testing and stuff,
They challenge it. They, like, put microbes in it to see if they'll grow.
Oh,
and
wow.
then they, yeah, it's kind of crazy how it goes.
Yeah. When we first started, I was like, oh, my God, alcohol testing is how much?
Right. $120?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I should have gone into something else, probably. Yeah. But it's working out okay. So that's the plan. And then do you have a limit on how many flavors eventually you want to have? Or are you just going to keep coming up?
Oh, my God,
or like...
no. So we're using a co-packer now, and he's always joking with me, like, stop making new flavors because we have 10.
Right. Let's back up.
Yeah.
So you were still producing it. You were making it. You were bottling it.
Yes.
You presumably hired somebody to help you
to do the deliveries, but I was still doing all the production.
And is there any
he came and helped out like once or twice to bottle. He hated it.
Is there like other than putting on, is there a
Because there's a seal. It's like a sealed bottle. Is there?
Or yeah, do you just like so put you have on the to bottle? Screw caps on, and then there's the plastic tamper seal.
Right.
So then you have to, I mean, individually slip those little pieces of plastic off,
right.
off itself and onto the bottle, and then blast it with a heat gun.
Yeah. Okay. So
yeah, I was and when using did you a little stop doing embossing that? Heat gun from Michaels.
Right. When did you move to a co-packer?
I moved to a co-packer when we got the news that we were losing the space in Greenpoint.
Got it.
Yeah. So they gave me 60 days to vacate. That was up from 30.
Right.
I basically went to them. I was like, this is not enough time. That's going to put my business under.
Right.
And I had a friend from working another job at the farmers markets who had a soda syrup company. And we had just kept in touch on Facebook mm-hmm. and Instagram. And he just randomly sent me a message like, hey, like I have all this staff and kitchen space and time. I'm thinking about getting into co-packing. So if that's something that you would ever be interested in talking about, like, let me know. And it just, I mean, it was 2 days after I got the notice from She-Wolf.
Right.
So it was just the exact right time. And I was like, okay, like, I don't know how long I want to do this, but like, let's have the conversation.
Right.
And I was thinking really it would be a stopgap measure. But honestly, as soon as I got out of that backbreaking
yeah.
production work.
No, I mean, you know, people have different, you know, different theories on, you know, whether you want to own your own production or you want to outsource it. At the end of yeah. the day, like, they don't mean like you physically making every
you single know? Bottle. I know it's my right. favorite question at the farmer's market. Oh, are you making this yourself?
Right.
Like, well,
yeah,
no.
So did you have to like bring your Scoby?
Yes.
How big is it?
Packed up. I mean, at that point we were brewing in five gallon glass jars. So it's about like a foot and a half in diameter. So I packed up all my glass jars full of SCOBY and
How
starter
many
culture and drove
do you have?
It up to him. That would be a question for Jason. I have at my house three, how many, Shelby?
Like three
or 4 gallon jars just filled with SCOBY, and that's not even the stuff that's actually fermenting right now. That's just sitting and growing.
Wow.
And then I know they have up at the kitchen at least 150 gallon barrel that's just filled with SCOBYs and starter.
Wow. What's
and
the difference
not
between
even
SCOBYs
counting.
And starter?
The starter's the actual liquid that right. it sits in.
I have a question just for my own personal self. Is it a lot of caffeine?
No, it's funny. We're actually just talking about posting this on our Instagram and website. We've been getting that question a lot lately. So tea, as you know, varies in caffeine content, with black tea being the highest, white tea being close to nothing. Most of the caffeine actually, they say ferments out, but it's actually the culture eats nitrogen that the caffeine gives off. So the right. caffeine degrades as it ferments.
Got
and
it.
So depending on the tea blend, and ours has a different tea for every kombucha, it can have as little as 2 or as much as like 20 milligrams. And for reference, a cup of coffee is 95 milligrams of caffeine.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So 20 would be like if I made a matcha kombucha.
Right.
That would be a lot of caffeine for kombucha.
Right. Now, in terms of, so again, going back to sort of our experience, we have a couple of things that we have on our radar in terms of competition. We know that there are going to be other brands that are going to be doing similar things. We also know that supermarkets are going to be doing a lot of private label. So, you know, they're going to have their own version of chimichurri or their own version of, you know, nutty lemongrass or whatever it is. And a lot of them have actually asked us to make them for them. Which we, you know, every company has this choice at some point to make, and it's not clear cut. You know, are we building the brand and are we trying to like get the brand out there, or do we do some of this private label stuff to just build volume, you know, and sales and get the money? But it can't be the exact same thing as the branded product, which means that we need to put resources into like developing that for them. I'm assuming places have come to you and asked you to do private label.
Yeah. From very early on,
yeah.
people asked us to do private label. I actually just got a message today. Some cafe asked us to do a private label kombucha for them.
And what are your thoughts on, you know, because there's a difference between like a co-brand, like let's do a fun collaboration, you know, But a private label means that you are not focused on pilot mm-hmm. and you're just selling something, which can be good for the bottom line and certainly keeps your co-packer producing, which is good. But what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that my co-packer doesn't have a problem with producing right now. We're basically taking up almost his entire weekly schedule, to be honest. And right. I'm still fighting for more. I need more. So, you know, if we had time and space, I would be happy to do that. I think it's a win-win for everybody. I don't necessarily have to have my name on the bottle.
Interesting. Yeah. So I could get my favorite celery and we could just call it Haven's Kitchen and call it a day. No, I really love, what's this?
It's celery, juniper. Yeah, it's my favorite too.
It's funny because the other two sold out immediately and this one, like, there were like two left and I'm like, well, people, you're missing
and
the
best one. I think I told you that when we did mm-hmm. the tasting. It's a polarizing flavor and people either love it or they think it's too weird to buy. Right. And I don't think I've ever had anybody taste it and be like, oh, that's gross. No,
right. No,
but best. You really have to try it before you buy it.
So do you have any, are you worried about competition at all? Who freaks
you out? Of course,
out?
Who isn't?
I mean, who, like, what scares you? Like, who scares you? The big ones or the little ones?
No, it's not the big ones. It's always the little ones. There's, you know, the people who maybe are doing it as a lark and not really focusing on actually building and scaling a business, who I feel like are just eating up your yep. market share and your shelf space.
Yep. By, like, the way, that happens in every...
Just get out of my way.
It's funny. It happens. I mean, it's totally random, but, like, we were talking about this with events at Havens the other day because someone, you know, asked us to do something for free. And we're like, you know, we're 6 years old. It's, you think that, you know, no offense, but, like, your hashtag or, like, tagging us is not going to actually be the amazing marketing push that you think it's going to be. Yeah. And it also doesn't pay the rent. But what we've gotten to is, like, there's always someone new who's willing to give it away for free, whether it's kombucha or their time or, you know, and the problem with that is that it really drags down everybody because then, you know, they're not building towards something bigger, but they're also taking market share away from those of us that are. So I feel like everyone should just start charging, you know, for their time, even if it's, you know, for
yeah,
everything.
I mean, you can almost get into it as a gendered thing as well.
Tell me how is it gendered?
Well, I mean, men get more funding for one, so their companies yeah, well, are more sure. likely to be giving away free product.
Yeah. I see what you're saying.
Women also undervalue totally. Their labor and their work yeah. and their efforts.
That's why I had to open Haven's Kitchen, because I was doing it at home, and I felt like I didn't have enough cred. It's also why yeah. I went back to get a master's degree, because I felt like, who's going to take me seriously, and why would anyone pay me money if I don't have some outside source validating me? I see what you mean about the gender. So you're worried more about, like, the small sort of, like, you know, I hate the word artisan, but, like, you're not worried
yeah,
about the,
I mean,
the big.
Not even like, yeah, I mean, it's always going to be a smaller, up and coming, yeah. more scrappy
right.
company who maybe doesn't know how the food business works. And, you know, we've gotten a lot of flack and trash talking about us because we're using a co-packer. So, like,
really?
Yeah. And it's you know, it's a very macho thing where people think they have to sweat and toil and do everything themselves. Right. But really, like, using a co-packer has allowed us to grow and scale
Absolutely.
And have me focus on the bigger picture for the business.
Absolutely.
It's been...
I think
honestly,
that paradigm is shifting. I really do. I think the paradigm of the founder who's, like, sleeping on the couch and blah, you know, like, I think
that's,
you know,
also a women-led movement.
100%. We don't have, first of all, I mean, I have 5 kids. Like, I'm not sleeping on the factory floor.
Yeah.
Right? My
yeah.
kids would not allow that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think secondly, like, we, you know, I do think that we don't. And it's funny because on one hand, we do have stuff to prove. On the other, we, you know, we don't have to prove that we've killed ourselves to feel like we've done something.
Well, we already know we're doing everything.
Exactly.
So.
We don't have anything to prove. So in terms of that competition and in terms of the threats, are you sort of actively always thinking about how to stay ahead of it? Are you thinking about like...
No.
How you're positioning yourself against
it? I mean, I'm always thinking about how I'm positioning myself, but honestly, I've found that for me and for my mental health, it's always a little bit better if I just compartmentalize it. Like, you can get into, with Instagram and everything, get into these really deep downward spirals and thinking about how to like stay on the cutting edge is never really, it just stresses me out. Right. So I just, I'll glance at everybody's Instagram and then I'll be like, okay, like time to get back to work and focus on what I'm doing and what we do well and what's our next flavor going to be that I'm really excited about, or like this ingredient that somebody sent me.
Yeah.
I think focusing on competition too much is a little bit unhealthy.
Totally.
And like, yeah, again, I think like, focusing on staying competitive and the cutting edge is a very macho thing that I can't deal with.
Well, it's funny because they're, we have to wrap up in a couple minutes, but I do think that, you do need to know who they are because you can't be an ostrich.
Right.
On the other hand, I think that, the biggest buffer against all of it is knowing who you are.
Exactly.
And always defining that language to yourself and who your people are, and that lesson just keeps coming up with everybody I have here, whether it's someone who does that for a living or another founder. It always comes back to people say you're 20%, you're 20%, those core people, and always thinking about them and speaking to them and knowing what you have, because I think there are a lot of things that don't have that core. Unfortunately, there are a lot of brands that have the core, but they haven't put it into words yet, or they haven't defined it for themselves yet.
Yeah, it's really hard.
It's a hard process, but it's something that I've really dug into recently because I want it to be clear. And in my brain, it's clear, but it's not always clear on the outside.
Yeah. So when we started branding and like really digging into like who our ideal customer was, the exercise we did was like the one single ideal customer, not the 20%, which I've never heard. And I got so specific and I was trying to read a lot about branding and going through this year where I was like, I'm not reading any books by men, which I still haven't done.
Have you read
Design
Thinking?
By the way? No, but I was going to recommend Branding is Sexy.
Oh, I like that.
It was one of the only branding books I was able to find that was by a woman.
Also Design Thinking by Debbie Millman.
Okay.
I'm telling you, it's awesome. It's interviews with there are a lot of men that she interviews, but it's through her lens. It's really good. All right. Last question. If you had to give one piece of advice to someone who's starting off, to yourself 3.5 years ago, what would it be?
Gosh, that's hard. There's so many. And I really just want to say
can give five.
Just do it and don't be afraid and ask for the price that you think is fair for the work that you're putting in, because it looks better if you start out high rather than starting low, because you feel like you have to be competitive, which you're small, you're one person, you're not going to be competitive. Just embrace that.
No, I think actually that's a really good rule of thumb too. You can always lower your prices.
You can always lower them. It looks really bad if you raise them. We had to do that. It was rough. I also think that going back to, focusing on the competition, just don't think about them. Don't think about what they're doing. Think about what you're doing and who your customer is.
And love them.
And love them and speak to them and take care of yourself. Meditate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do something nice for yourself every day. Like drink kombucha or meditate or go to yoga class. Prioritize your mental health. It's critical as a small business owner to do that. And it's
true.
Not talked about often, but you can go through high highs and low lows.
For sure.
Yeah.
All right. So here's to lots of high highs and not that many low lows. Thank you, Alex, for coming on the show.
Yeah,
Matt,
thank you for
engineering the show. Ladies, thank you for videoing the show. And I'll see you next time on In the Sauce.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.